It's an honor and a privilege to be able to introduce you, General. An honor and a privilege, particularly for one whose military career fizzled out many years ago as a first lieutenant. I suppose as, in fact, the last serving officer of the Harvard Law School faculty. General Westmoreland was born in 1914 in South Carolina and made his way thence to West Point, graduating from there in 1936. And then came the war. Famous humorist, Mr. Dooley once had a dialogue about the Spanish-American War in which somebody says it's a terrible war, and the other one said, sure, but it's no better than no war at all. And in his military career, the general has had three of them. World War II saw him with the field artillery and infantry in the heat of it. Then came what I still think of sort of as my war, the Korean police action, to be technical, with an airborne combat team. The years between, he then filled as chief of staff of the 82nd Airborne, commander of the other great airborne division, superintendent of military academy, and then came Vietnam. I'm much more comfortable saying that than I might have been introducing the general at a forum here in 1968 or 1969. It was not a popular event here at Harvard, and indeed those were tumultuous times. But now, several years later, years which for him have represented, among other things, being chief of staff of the United States Army, we can think about those events and their repercussions from some distance. John Westmoreland has written A Soldier Reports, and he has participated in another hostile encounter, this time with a group whose weapons, though somewhat primitive in a way, can inflict wounds, the media. And he has come primarily to tell you about his experiences with CBS and with the legal fraternity. Many people have raised doubts about the equity, the fairness of both the media and parts of the legal process. An author, Renata Adler, has written at length about her questions as to whether justice was in fact done or about to be done when the matter was settled. And now the general is here to tell you his side, his perspective on it. Sir, I present the troops. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor. Ladies and gentlemen, I am pleased to be here at Harvard. Professor didn't mention that I was a student at the Harvard Business School a number of years ago, which I know is not Harvard to you, but it was Harvard to me at the time. But as I look around the room and I see some of my former comrades in arms, some of them in the uniform of Vietnam, and I'm sure in the audience there are many others. You know, a good part of my service was devoted to commanding paratroopers. And I remember when I was a lieutenant colonel many years ago, I was inspecting a parachute infantry company. And I approached the first young man. I said, young man, do you like to jump? Of course, I was talking about jumping out of an airplane. He says, yes, sir, I love to jump. So I approached this next young man. I said, what about you, lad? Do you like to jump? Yes, sir, I love it. I jump every time I have the opportunity. I then turned to the third young man and I said, what about you, trooper? Do you like to jump? No, sir. I hate it. It scares me to death. Well, what are you doing in this outfit? He says, sir, I just likes to be around people who does like to jump. Now, the relevance of that story is that I do like to be with lawyers and up-and-coming potential lawyers and students and certainly veterans. But I don't like to be in a courtroom. And that's what you have here. Now, you will read Westmoreland versus CBS some places, but you will not read Westmoreland versus CBS in the Federal Supplement. I'm sure, however, that it will open anew a pursuit to your Socratic tormentors to put a law school student through dialectic hoops to the discomfort of the chosen one and to the relief and edification of the rest. So perhaps my visit can even forewarn you on this or forearm you. Now, if some of you have read a book that was referred to by the professor, Renata Adler's Reckless Disregard, in the name of her book, published by Knopf, and earlier Don Kowit's book called A Matter of Honor, published by Macmillan, let me tempt you with the promise of forbidden fruit, because CBS tried to keep both books from being published. Now, I'm not here to discuss Vietnam, but I'd be happy to deal with Vietnam in whatever dimension you choose during the question period. But I'm at the stage now where I want to leave Vietnam to the historians. Nor shall I speculate on CBS motives in conjuring up its extravagantly hyped so-called documentary, The Uncounted Enemy of Vietnam Deception, 14 years after the Tet Offensive. I don't want to leave both of those to psychiatrists and perhaps Marable dictu, even to some penitent autobiography. Of course, all of us now appreciate that television inevitably becomes a part of the event. It brings into our homes controversial facts, a train wreck, the Super Bowl, an earthquake, astronauts walking on the moon. Those pictures speak for themselves. Yet inevitably, the television pictures also speak for themselves with the same impact when they are not facts in the same sense. Their selection, their sequence, their emphasis can mislead. In such cases, the viewer's perception of such a picture can be flawed, as those who see through their own eyes that the earth is flat. Obviously, the Americans who each evening saw on TV in the 1960s such selected footage from Vietnam had an awareness and perception of war in Vietnam far different from his non-TV perception has given him of the 7 years of the war in Afghanistan. Succinctly, CBS violation of its own professional standards called into service all the legerdemain of TV to produce a documentary that had no basis in fact, in order to project for their viewers' own eyes a scoop of the infamous villainy in which I was cast as the heavy. Now, after reading the entire record, including the depositions involved, Renata Adler, in her book Reckless Disregard, who incidentally is a professional journalist, but also a graduate of a prestigious law school somewhat south of here in a place called Yale, she wrote, and I quote from that book, "Because though the program may have been produced within the CBS News Department and even purported to present a major scoop that Westmoreland's conspiracy to deceive had led to a military defeat at Tet and to the ultimate loss of the war, the program was clearly not, in any conventional sense, news. Nor were its producers and interviewers journalists. And the scoop, as the statement would have it, the perspective was demonstrably wrong. Westmoreland led no such conspiracy. Tet was a public relations catastrophe, but not a military defeat. And though the war was lost, the loss could hardly be attributed to a conspiracy or defeat that never was. The role of the media is, needless to say, of special significance. We all will agree that the media in our society is important, indeed essential to the maintenance of democracy and our free society. There is disagreement on the fairness, ethics, and propriety of some associated with the media. The First Amendment to our Constitution is basic to our free society. But the First Amendment, as shaped by the Sullivan Opinion, gives tremendous power to the media. If that power is handled recklessly, our society can be endangered. Joseph Pulitzer's advice was sound, but has not been practiced by some awarded the prestigious Pulitzer Prize, which carried Joseph Pulitzer's name. He said that reporters and writers should, and I quote, put it before them briefly so they will read it, clearly so that they will appreciate it, picturesquely so that they will remember it, and above all, accurately so that they will be guided by its light. Now, my remarks this evening may not be appreciated by some, nor will they be picturesque nor providing guiding lights. But I hope that it will meet the Pulitzer standard of brevity. My experience with the media has in many cases been disillusioning. And I must say tonight I'm letting off a bit of steam. Maybe you might say pent-up steam. Which reminds me of Brother Joseph, who was a Trappist monk. The Trappist order, as you may know, is an order where the monks take a vow of silence. Brother Joseph was put into a Trappist monastery. And for the first year, he studied, he read, he prayed. He could not speak and did not speak a word. But at the end of the first year, the priest in charge called all the Trappist monks together and said, "You will be allowed after Mass on Sunday, two words." They called on Brother Joseph, and he says, "Hard bed." 2 more years went by. No speaking, praying, reading. Again, a notice appeared on the bulletin board that after Mass on Sunday, each Trappist monk would be allowed 2 words. And when the priest in charge called on Brother Joseph, he says, "Bad food." Another year went by, reading and studying, but no speaking. And again, a notice appeared that after Mass on Sunday, each Trappist monk would be allowed 2 words. And when the priest in charge called on Brother Joseph, he said, "I quit." The priest in charge then said, "Brother Joseph, it's about time. All you've done for 3 years is complain." Now, having survived, and I use that word advisedly, 2 years of preparation and some 5 months of courtroom legalities, trying to obtain from a major TV network what to me seemed to be simple justice, I emphasized the plight of a public figure whose performance is unfairly degraded, his honor is impugned, and his loyalty is questioned. A soldier's honor is precious to him. That is his basic remuneration. You don't go into the military service and pursue a professional career to make money. You have motives that are in terms of serving your country and the remuneration that one might get in civilian life is not present. Now, I tried to get some retraction. I tried to get an apology or some kind of action that would eliminate the need for taking stronger action. This did not transpire, so I sued for libel. Unfortunately, there is no solution other than a letter to the editor at one extreme and suing for libel at the other. Now, this may be a plus for lawyers who would lose a lot of business if there was something in between. But it is not a plus for a public figure, particularly for a non-wealthy career soldier. Now, some journalists feel that what public figures really want to do is to muzzle a sense of the press. But we are in favor of a free press only as long as we are not the target. I can assure you that in my own case, I would have welcomed what the chairman of CBS, of all people, once enunciated. He said, "The principle of fairness and balance is a cornerstone of our news and public policy." That, presumably, was a policy of CBS. A policy that I did not recognize during my ordeal. Now, why did I cooperate with Mike Wallace? After I retired in July of 1972, I felt an obligation to play a role in setting the record straight on the war in Vietnam and the role and work and effectiveness of the veteran who fought that war, and hence planned and did accept each and every invitation to talk about my 4.5 years in Vietnam, where we tried to carry out national policy in our nation's most controversial war. CBS apparently observed my conduct to accept any and all invitations to talk about Vietnam, during which time, I say, I took an awful lot of abuse, particularly on college campuses, but I didn't let it deter me. And CBS were quite confident that they could grill me on tape. And I agreed to be interviewed by Mike Wallace, who I knew, to participate in what he described as a fair and objective documentary of 90-minute duration. Soon after the interview began, I realized that I was caught in an ambush. I was skillfully set up. There were two cameras going, bright lights. When Mr. Wallace was talking, I didn't know the camera was on me, and because of bright lights, my lips were dry. And I tried to moist my lips so I would be prepared to answer his next question. But if you saw the documentary, a good part of it showed me sitting there under those lights, licking my lips. During that time, Mr. Kral, the director, was passing messages to Mr. Wallace, advising him on how to get me, and that was Mr. Wallace's charge, is to get me. Now, to give you a better idea of what the program was all about, let me explain. When American troops arrived in Vietnam, we had no choice but to accept the intelligence on the enemy provided by the South Vietnamese Army. We soon learned that they were not estimates, they were basically guesstimates. And hence my intelligence staff set about to get a better handle on the size and shape of the enemy. After many months of study, a new estimate was presented to me. I faulted not the numbers involved, which I was not concerned about, but the categories which placed into the military order of battle. And an order of battle is a representation of the troops that you want, the enemy troops that you want your troops to destroy. But I objected to placing in the military order of battle unarmed, so-called self-defense persons, many of whom were women, old men, and boys. At a time when I was putting strong emphasis on the avoidance of civilian casualties, I directed that armed members of that group be placed in the guerrilla category and the unarmed be placed in the category along with the civilian political category outside of the military order of battle. I was very sensitive to international law, the Geneva Conventions, and the laws of war. It so happened that as a lieutenant colonel, I taught at the Commander General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and one of the subjects that I taught was the Geneva Convention and the rules of land warfare. The Geneva Conventions, which delineated the laws of land warfare, actually initiated the first meeting, I think, was in 1886 in Brussels. Subsequently, there were meetings in Geneva, Switzerland. Participants in these meetings were the Western powers. The purpose was to try to get an agreement on laws and regulations and procedures that would protect to the maximum extent practical civilian lives. So I was very sensitive about this matter, since I had taught it at the Commander General Staff College, and I called in my judge advocate and my intelligence officer and my operations officer, and using those documents as a guide, developed rules of engagement to be followed by the troops on that very difficult battlefield. All responsible officials, up to Mr. Helms, who was the head of the CIA, to include my military boss, Admiral Sharp, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, approved the sorting out and the categorization of the enemy that would not put in the order of battle, the military order of battle, known unarmed civilians. That was basically Producer Crowell's conspiracy, a conspiracy led by me. I don't think Mr. Crowell or anybody understood basically what this was all about. I think they were oblivious to the fact that the military does operate under international law. And that during the course of Vietnam, we religiously adhered to the letter and the principles of that law. On the other hand, Oriental societies were not involved in the Geneva Conventions, and the North Vietnamese never did. One of the first things I did was to invite the International Red Cross to come to the battlefield and gave them a carte blanche to go anywhere they chose. I asked them to inspect the prisoner of war compounds that were set up, which they did, and our compounds fully met their criteria. But the North Vietnamese never allowed them to get behind their lines. Now for the alleged second sin, infiltration of North Vietnamese regular soldiers into South Vietnam in huge numbers, in the order of 20,000 a month, starting in the early fall of 1967 and continuing. Mr. Wallace grilled me on this matter, and I made some misstatements with respect to numbers which came to mind. I didn't remember the exact numbers, but I made some misstatements. Since I was not prepared to deal with figures dating back 14 years, and I wasn't aware that I would be asked to regurgitate figures going back that far. After the interview, I felt very uncomfortable about the figures that I'd given, although during the course of the interview, I had some second thoughts and attempted to say that I wasn't at all confident that the figures I'd given were correct and I'd have to research them, which I did. I went to the records in Washington, researched it, and I wrote a letter to Producer Crowell and Mike Wallace stating the facts. Believing that I was dealing with honorable men who, as they stated, were attempting to produce an accurate and objective documentary, I did not feel it necessary to ask them to correct the manuscript of my interview. Since my expressed facts did not jibe with Mr. Crowell's showbiz blue sheets, the letter that I wrote was ignored. Now, as to the third point, the Tet Offensive was alleged by the broadcast to be a surprise and an American defeat because of faulty intelligence, for which, according to Mr. Carl and Mr. Wallace, I was responsible for. I sent documentation to them, to both Mr. Wallace and Mr. Carl, the producer, reflecting the contrary. I thought it was full and adequate documentation that they were off on the wrong track, which they were. That also was in contradiction to Mr. Crowell's, the producer's, blue sheets. So that was discarded. On Tuesday morning, following the Saturday night hatchet job, I held a press conference in Washington. Present at the press conference, in addition to myself, was Ambassador Bunker, who at the time was not only, he was my boss on the scene, he was the president's personal representative on the scene, he was the American ambassador in Saigon. Also present was Mr. George Carver, who was the deputy director of the CIA, who was responsible for intelligence on Vietnam. Also was my intelligence chief, General Philip Davison, who they did not interview because they alleged he was sick, which he was not. And he made it very clear that they were totally off base on the thrust of the broadcast. Also, there were two people that reported to General Davison, a Colonel Grimm, who was then a general officer, and a Colonel Charlie Morris, who operated directly and were associated with all estimates and were experts in intelligence. They reported to my J2, General Davison, who reported to my chief of staff, who reported to me. All of these people who were responsibly involved with intelligence in Vietnam were present at the press conference. The several salient accusations are in innuendos in the broadcast were addressed by those in position of responsibility and authority. I asked, after that press conference was only for an apology. Nothing else. Dan Rather mentioned the press conference on the evening news that day and stated that I had objected to the broadcast, but CBS stood by the broadcast, but they would look into it in view of my complaint and would report back. They never looked into it and never reported back. That promise was not carried out, and neither was a recommendation by a man named the senior producer at CBS, Bud Benjamin, who is a senior producer. He reportedly recommended, after my press conference, which was videotaped into the CBS headquarters in New York, a place that's referred to as Black Rock. It was videotaped into the headquarters of CBS and was seen by many of the senior people, to include the senior producer, Bud Benjamin. And he strongly recommended to the officials at CBS News that my press conference be broadcasted on prime time, but that advice was rejected. The fact of the matter is that the senior producer of the network, who was assigned to make an independent analysis, who also happened to be Bud Benjamin, he analyzed the controversial broadcast, which was intentionally targeted at me, and pointed out that the program used 9 interviewees who seemed to support the charge and only 2 in opposition. And I was one of those. So in addition to myself, there was General Grimm, who I think there was about 90 seconds that was shown on the documentary. In addition, those known to me to be supportive of me were interviewed during the preparation of the documentary, and no part of the interview was used for one reason or another. It was simply, according to them, inconvenient to interview those many people, and those that made comments contrary to the phony thesis of the broadcast, they did not see fit to use. The last one was interviewed was the number two man in the CIA, George Carver, who told Mr. Kral that the broadcast was false. The senior CBS producer further concluded that the broadcast contained serious flaws. A conspiracy, given the accepted definition of the word, was never proven. In several instances, tapes were cut to allow questions from one interview to be answered by responses from another. Now, this investigation made by Bud Benjamin was brought about because of the TV Guide article that was an expose of the documentary, and that created quite a stir, so that the powers to be in CBS appointed Bud Benjamin, the senior producer, to make an independent analysis. And he found those things which I have mentioned. Now, again, the purpose in reciting this tale is not to rehash the case, but to bring out the point that the network itself took a responsible action in initiating an in-house review of the program. Strangely, a review that they refused to make public. CBS continued to say that they stood by the broadcast. I was represented by the Capital Legal Foundation, a not-for-profit organization in Washington, D.C. Contributions to that were tax-exempt, and that made it possible financially for me to take on the wealthy media giant. Otherwise, it would have been impossible. Now, why did I settle before the trial was over? First, let me make the point that the myth that my attorney betrayed me is incorrect. My attorney did not betray me. Near the end of the trial, I waived with my attorney, Mr. Dan Burke, our chances with the jury, and decided to accept a settlement after the judge imposed an inordinately high burden of proof on my attorney before a jury dealing with matters unfamiliar to them. Further, I was disillusioned by the large number of low-level, narrowly focused witnesses for the defense who were allowed to present to the jury in the context of state of mind hearsay evidence, to which they were exposed as very young analysts in the CIA, working the bowels of the CIA 16 years earlier, at which time they were in their early 20s. After considerable consideration, I assessed my chances with the jury on the matter of truth, and I concluded that it was no better than 50-50, and I could not accept such odds. CBS wanted to settle because my attorney had not cross-examined Mike Wallace, who would have been plagued with a number of contradictions and evidence that he was basically ignorant of the subject matter. Finally, CBS agreed to language that I interpreted as totally at odds with the thrust of the broadcast. Also, I'd run out of money, I'd run out of funds. I was concerned, even if we had won the case, that CBS, with its wealth, would have carried the case for a decade or more up through review channels to the Supreme Court, and I frankly didn't have the money and I didn't have a lawyer that could have represented me during that process. To CBS, of course, that was no problem, because they were covered not only because of their wealth, but they were covered by insurance. I certainly had no insurance of that type. A recent Supreme Court decision states, and this is a quote, "It is the right of the viewer, not the right of the broadcaster, that is paramount." This seems to be lost somewhere among the Fourth Estate, particularly the television segment. Some, but only a few in the Fourth Estate, spoke out on that subject. For instance, an issue of the Columbia Journalism Review commented editorially at that time on the verdicts rendered in the two concurrent libel cases that were in the public eye at the time, including my own and that of General Sharon, who, of course, sued Time. Now, let me quote from the Columbia Journalism Review. It said, every big libel trial has two verdicts. The formal judgment determines whether the aggrieved party is entitled to damages for harm to his reputation. The other judge weighs the performance of the news organization and the journalists involved. As to the Westmoreland case, said the Columbia Journalism Review, the network tended to hype. The presentation amounted to historical oversell, the casting of an old issue of the Vietnam War as a new and dramatic revelation. Moreover, documents disclosed from the trial showed that there had been internal oversell in CBS and manipulation as well, and the network took a prolonged public beating for those shortcomings. A New York Magazine was one that took a strong stand and captured the principles involved. This was over the byline of Michael Diamond. He described the so-called victory parties that CBS had, celebrating at regimes and other Manhattan night spots, and comments that the dancing on the grave of Westmoreland's case suggests how little the network really learned from his three-year-long battle over the documentary. All pain and no gain. Diamond reports that even people within the network were critical of the producer and went about proving his thesis using unacceptable journalistic tactics, ignoring interviews that didn't fit his storyline, failing to identify one analyst as a paid consultant to the network, and coaching a source, another witness, to get stronger TV. The real villain, said Mr. Diamond, is a system that delivers journalistic judgments and unambivalent, this is how it is style. Strong television admits no shades of gray. Network television takes the high ground and then refuses to yield it for correction and rebuttal. CBS kept saying it had nothing to apologize for. Several years after the trial's denouement, most Americans still know only what Renata Adler terms the lore of the trial, which was handed down by the media. Except for a few pharaohs, the bitter irony of CBS's unsuccessful efforts to halt publication of the COVID book, A Matter of Honor, and Adler's book, Reckless Disregard, both followed by CBS' chilling campaign of intimidation against the books, generally, and this went generally unnoticed by the media, and timely and sympathetic acquiescence. There were few editorial expressions of concern for the First Amendment, in marked contrast with the editorial reaction to CBS's resolution after my press conference to stand by its documentary. The media's almost yoke response to my press conference and then the period between the press conference and trial, either their silence or their disdainful reporting of the awkward facts about CBS violating professional ethical standards in the planning production, and during the 6 months or so before the CBS documentary was aired, was such great fanfare and self-praise. Before the broadcast, it was extensively advertised. CBS took out a full-page ad in the New York Times, Washington Post, and several other large papers throughout the country. They devoted on Thursday before the Saturday night airing at least 15 minutes of their morning news, where Diane Sawyer promotes the broadcast. And heralds it as a coup, a great breakthrough through by the media. The full paid advertisements had a cartoon of officers sitting around a table with the word conspiracy. Of legendary is the relentless resourcefulness of the media in exposing incompetence, breach of trust, dishonesty, violations of law, and shared moral principles. I mean, this is done well and very assiduously by the media to reveal incompetence and breaches of trust and dishonesty, and we see this going on now, and we've seen it in the past. But significantly, with the royal acquiescence of their peers, 5 years after the documentary's airing, its principles not only are prominent in CBS News, but continue apparently to enjoy the esteem of their peers and unimpaired credibility. And of course, I'm referring to Mr. Wallace and Mr. Crowell. Now, why is this? The issue is not Vietnam. The issue is the flagrant violation of professional standards and the bearing of false witness by CBS in the production of the documentary, and then its baneful cover-ups, including their attempts to halt the production of two books, and followed by two chilling campaigns against those books with their brethren in the media. Sometime still in the future, the media will have to grasp the nettles. The First Amendment exists for the protection of all of us. It's not just the patent of the imperial media. Even the giants who have modestly worn the mantle and accepted the laurels as media role models have remained silent. After 5 years, they still have not followed the counsel they so generously give and expect others to follow. If not for contraction, at least with deliberate speed. I have attempted to set the stage for your questions. I repeat again, and if we want to get into Vietnam, I'd be happy to talk about any aspect of that that I am capable of discussing. So, as far as I'm concerned, with the permission of the chairman, we can proceed with the questions.
Why don't we line up questions on either? We'll alternate mics.
First question.
The detail of your recall reveals considerable pain and agony over your ordeal, and I take that all at face value. It strikes me that in some sense you may be a victim, not so much of CBS or the media, but maybe in a larger sense of a broader societal and almost psychological trend. Are you familiar with a book called A Choice of Heroes?
I couldn't get that.
Are you familiar with a book called A Choice of Heroes?
Choice of Heroes?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. I'm not.
Well, the author in that book suggests that there was a time in our history, I guess when you were growing up, when the soldiers and the generals were held out as the heroes of society, as the protectors of our security and so on. And he suggests that since the advent of the nuclear bomb, that the thought of winning a war or winning a nuclear war is no longer possible, and suggests that the old archetype of the soldier as hero is obsolete now, and that we must think in terms of other heroes, maybe mediators or some such. It's probably an unsettling notion to you, but Do you think there's any validity to that thesis?
There probably is some to it. frankly, it is not evident as one travels throughout this country. And I do a lot of traveling from east to west and north to south. And I admit that frequently I talk to priests of the choir, so to speak. In other words, I talk to Vietnam veterans. I am... pretty much their self-appointed spokesman, because I am the senior officer living today who was in Vietnam for many years. So perhaps my views are somewhat warped by the segment of the population that I am thrown with. I don't see any evidence of it in that segment. But I'm sure it is not a cross-section, and I'm sure that your thesis is probably valid in a segment. What percentage, nobody knows. I don't know.
General, the 5 o'clock briefings in Vietnam, the MACV briefings, were called the 5 o'clock follies because reporters said that essentially, although the briefers from your staff never lied, what they did was they lied by omission and by characterization. They told not the true story, but the story they wanted Americans to hear. The reporters, of course, then went out and did their own thing. It seemed as if somehow an adversarial process was created. Whether or not that's the best one for journalism or law, I'm not sure.